proceed to the third case of the day, Cooney v. Cassidy. Mr. Goldner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Richard Goldner. I represent Deborah Cooney in this matter. She is appealing the decision of the District Court granting the defendant's summary judgment. It is our belief, based on the evidence in this case, in the light taken most favorable to the plaintiff, that the jury could clearly find that the transcripts of Deborah's DCFS administrative hearings were altered, that the alterations...
You know, as you use that term altered throughout your papers, I kept thinking of it. For there to be an alteration, there has to be a version of it that is then changed. Do you have any proof that there was a prior version of those transcripts?
We have no proof that there was a prior transcripts.
So what you're really saying is the transcription was falsified, it was falsely transcribed or erroneously transcribed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not
yes.
Altered.
Yes.
Okay.
And we believe the evidence, if in taken most favorably towards the plaintiff at trial, would show that. Obviously, at this point, no witnesses have testified, so credibility of witnesses was not determined by the court. But clearly what was shown was, on May 1st, 2007, the Department of Children and Family Services placed an order with Benedia reporting the described proceedings. First two proceedings on May 7th, which were the September 12th, 2006 and September 14th, 2006 proceedings, were transcribed by Ms. Magnavasco with no errors whatsoever. At that point, the agents of the defendants, Cassidy and Sadnowski, would have known that she was transcribing the transcripts. Between May 11th and June...
By the way, how would they know that she would do all of the transcripts? Was there some evidence that was the pattern, that when that service was hired, the same person did all of them, or...
I believe the same person did all the transcribing. That is my understanding.
Well, yeah, it may be in this instance, but was that a pattern that had been done in the past, or how do they know that she does two out of, what, five or six transcripts? How did they know she's going to do the others?
I believe they had been dealing with that company for quite a few years, so they know whoever started on the transcripts would continue.
And that's somewhere in your papers?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Yes.
And the thing is that the transcripts that were completed afterwards between May 11th, 2007 and June 1st, 2007 contained an unbelievable number of errors. The errors that benefited the Department of Children and Family Services case. Also, it came out during the course of the case that Ms. Magnavasco had no medical background or training whatsoever, would not have independently known which alterations to make to benefit DCF's case against Deborah Cooney. And defendants Cassidy and Sosnowski would have known what alterations to make to benefit the Department of Children's and Family Services case against Deborah Cooney, and they were the attorneys representing DCFS.
Wasn't Cassidy out of the case by that point? Didn't he get out of the case by January or so?
I believe she was still in the case at that point. But she was still connected with. Again, this is like injecting dye into a bloodstream and seeing where it goes. There are numerous mistakes here. There are 10 pages of mistakes with respect to this transcript, respect to the transcripts, almost all of which benefited DCFS. clearly there, throughout the course of the case, throughout the course of the depositions, there was no explanation for how all these errors occurred and how so many of them influenced against the plaintiff. And I believe it is very clear, just looking at the timeline of what happened, that that a jury could conclude that the three parties worked in conspiracy to make this happen. As a result of this, now again, in fact, Ms. Cooney is in the medical field. This particular indication by DCFS is death to her profession. She can no longer work in her profession if this is known. She, because of these errors in transcripts, because of the mistakes.
The verbatim transcript that your client had prepared by way of a court reporter at the hearing was substituted for the transcript that had the errors in it, and that transcript that was prepared by the paralegal for the department was a transcription from the audio cassette.
Yes.
So what is the harm here? Because the decision was ultimately reviewed on the basis of a verbatim transcript that your client had prepared.
The decision was ultimately made that it was moot. After a certain amount of time, a DCFS ruling is automatically expunged. She never had the opportunity to clear herself because of this.
I'm sorry, it's expunged?
Yes. Everybody knows it's there.
So how is there a record of it then?
Because of all the jobs she applied for because they were in the medical field. She was at that point poisoned. She had no opportunity to undo this. It expired by lapse of time, and she had no opportunity to clear herself because of this.
I'm sorry. I'm not following. What expired and what was expunged?
Okay, the indicated finding against Mrs. Cooney was expunged after, I believe it's a 5-year period. By the time this case came to hearing, with the corrected transcripts and everything in the place it should be, it was a moot issue. It no longer existed, so the courts would not hear it. So she never had the opportunity to clear herself. She never had her day in court to clear this indication.
Well, if the Magna Bosco transcript never became the transcript for the proceeding, how did that cause these rumors or?
She had an indicated finding against her. She appealed the indicated finding.
And the indicated finding was made prior to the transcription, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Transcription is made but never becomes the actual transcript?
Correct.
Because the live court reporter transcript is utilized?
Because ultimately, alternate court reporter transcripts is utilized. And while all this is happening, the lapse of time eliminates her appeal because it becomes moot. And a DCFS finding stays on your record for a period of time. After that time, it is automatically expunged and ceases to exist, except everybody knew it was there before. All the places she had applied to for jobs.
The finding was made before the Magna Bosco transcript.
Correct. And then she appealed that finding. And that's what the Magna Bosco transcripts were for the appeal.
But they were never used.
They were never used, but because of the errors and all the controversy that went with it, enough time passed where she lost her appeal. She never had the opportunity to reverse it on its merits. So all the places that she had gone to apply for, jobs where she had been rejected, knew of the DCFS finding. And they know it disappears in 5 years, but it's still there. She is at this point an indicated person who has never reversed that decision. Those are her damages in this case. She has had her career destroyed because of this and never had the opportunity to undo it.
Do you have any other evidence of a conspiracy between the two department attorneys and the paralegal who prepared the transcript other than the discrepancies between the two transcripts?
The discrepancies, the opportunity of Cassidy and Sosnowski, the fact that Magna Bosco admittedly had no medical background, the fact that the alterations...
Do you have a single communication among those three?
No. We have only circumstantial evidence. We have no direct evidence. That is our sole basis for the case.
Well, in fact, the uncontradicted evidence is that the two attorneys didn't ever meet with this paralegal who prepared the transcript or talk to her in any or communicate with her in any way.
We could not prove any communication. That is correct.
Do you want to reserve some time for rebuttal, Mr. Goldman?
I'll reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr.
Crooks?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Picking up on that last issue, there actually was no evidence that Cassidy and Sosnowski even knew who Magna Bosco was, knew who the person was that would transcribe these tapes. And it's easy to understand, they were lawyers that worked at the trial stage. Once they were done with their job, the administrative law judge made a recommendation. DCFS went along with that recommendation. They were off to another case. Cassidy, in fact, had withdrawn from the Cooney matter before it was completed. They had no interest in who was going to do these tapes because they were going to have no part in the administrative review that followed. This case, actually, is one of 9 or 10 cases that Mrs. Cooney filed that arose out of her divorce and child custody proceedings. In 2009, Judge Aspin dismissed Cooney versus Rossiter, which claimed a conspiracy amongst the state court judge, court-appointed child psychiatrist, the child's representative, Cooney's ex-husband's attorney, the child's therapist, based on immunity as to some defendants, based on implausibility. Judge Aspin dismissed that case.
There was a prior suit against the court reporter as well.
That's correct. She was sued in state court.
Were there findings in any of those other proceedings of frivolousness?
I would say in Judge Aspin's opinion, yes, and as it came up to this court, there is finding of frivolousness. In fact, this court, when they affirmed Judge Aspin's dismissal of that case, called it paranoid pro se litigation alleging a vast encompassing conspiracy. And importantly, when Judge Aspin dismissed that case, Cooney asked leave to file an amended complaint adding the very defendants in this case. So when she filed this lawsuit, she was actually filing a lawsuit that Judge Aspin had denied her leave to file as an amended complaint. The court is correct. The plaintiff has no evidence of a conspiracy other than these transcripts. And it's really easy to look at what we have here. On one hand, we have not a certified court reporter, but a paralegal who works for a law firm who on a part-time basis does transcripts from audio cassettes. The undisputed evidence is that the audio cassettes on occasion broke, that there were times when the tape was not running. She was left with listening to an audio tape, not there, as court reporters sometimes do, break into the testimony to get clarification on a word. So, there were mistakes in those transcripts. There were inaudibles in those transcripts. But as we've laid out in our brief, the inaudibles go both ways. Oftentimes, a passage that Cooney says, hey, this evidence that helps me is not in Magna Bosco's transcripts, and we cite example after example where that same evidence appeared a few lines or a page later. There are citations we provided in our brief that show other times where material that was inaudible in the Moscow transcripts, which was damning to Cooney, was present in the Fishman transcripts. So what she did was cherry-pick these and claim that she had an argument that you could draw an inference from, and the fact is no inference could be drawn because the errors in transcribing, which are easily explainable, went both ways. And it's important, and the court, I asked questions about this, but it's important that there are no damages here, even if there had been this wild-eyed conspiracy, because the fact is the recommendation by the administrative law judge and the acceptance of that recommendation by DCFS all occurred before the transcripts were prepared by Magda Bosco. When they got to the administrative review judge in state court, the Fishman transcripts, Cooney's transcripts of choice, were used.
What about this argument that by then it was moot?
At some point, it was moot. The 5 years had passed. In other words, by the law just having a time limit, Cooney got her desired outcome at 5 years. Now, within a year of the administrative review, the Fishman transcripts had been substituted. What they did in the administrative review that had it go on for so long has nothing to do with my clients.
So Illinois law provides that if the appeal is not concluded within 5 years, the original finding is expunged? Is that how it works?
What she is seeking is to have the finding expunged, and the law says after 5 years it is expunged.
Okay.
So she's in the same spot after that 5 years.
Yeah,
now, maybe she feels good if she's able to win on the merits, but as a matter of law, it makes no difference. And as far as everything counsel said about her having job difficulties and things along these lines, when she was deposed, she was working as a nurse in Ohio. There's nothing in the record indicating that her career was impacted in any way. What this case really is about, because I don't think there's any question the district court should be affirmed for granting summary judgment, I think the district court should be reversed, and we have asked that it be reversed for not granting fees to the defendants in this case.
Well, the district court was aware of this background and the history that you've talked about here, and exercising its discretion, determined that this was not frivolous. In fact, denied a 12B6 motion and ultimately concluded that this was not vexatious, frivolous, meritless, etc.
Only partially correct, Your Honor. What the district court said was it was not frivolous, however, it was meritless. And meritless is precisely the word used for awarding fees under 42 U.S.C. Section 1988. And I would argue under Rule 11, a reading of that rule also tells us that a meritless case should be considered. Although I think in this case, Section 1988 is the more likely context.
Were you seeking the fees against Ms. Cooney or against Mr. Goldner or both?
We're seeking the fees against Ms. Cooney, Mr. Goldner, as well as the other lawyers that were assisting Ms. Cooney as she testified in her deposition.
How could the court reach those other lawyers? They didn't sign any pleadings, so they don't fit under Rule 11. They're not parties.
Judge, while we don't have any case that says this, I've never seen a case that addresses this, when lawyers say, we will help you with your case, you look at the pleadings in there, and you can tell they're lawyer-drafted. The response to motion to dismiss was clearly lawyer-drafted. We'll do all the work, but we don't want to put our name on these papers. I think it creates the appearance that they did that exactly because they feared Rule 11 if they were to put their signature on these papers. I think under those circumstances, on remand, the district court can look at those issues.
Doesn't that violate the attorney's code of conduct?
Pardon me?
That activity.
I believe so.
The attorney's code of conduct in Illinois?
I would agree with that, absolutely.
How can you identify those attorneys that you say drafted it?
She testified at her deposition to the assistance they provided her in great detail, and that's all in the record.
Is that the point at which the district court ordered at least one of these attorneys to appear? Or how did that come
about? Well, I would say a strong suggestion by the district court that Mr. Goldner file his appearance. The judge was dealing with a pro se litigant at status hearings, et cetera. Mr. Goldner came to assist at one point, and I think the judge correctly just said, look, clean up the record here. You just go ahead and file your appearance so I can deal with you rather than a pro se litigant. That's when that happened. I think that was appropriate.
How did Mr. Goldner appear before the court? Of course, I'll ask him. And the judge then asks, are you the attorney? How does she direct or request that he file an appearance? Is he standing before the court?
He was standing before the court, Your Honor. It was a status appearance, as I recall, and he was trying to assist Ms. Cooney and assist the court. I've seen this happen in other cases.
No, I appreciate it, but how was it represented to the court initially, that Mr. Goldner was a friend assisting?
Was assisting her. That's how I recall it. Although, frankly, her deposition testimony indicated that it was the other two lawyers who are identified in the brief that primarily were doing this, assistance and preparing the briefs, et cetera.
Was the district court aware of their role at that point?
Not until the summary judgment briefings. There had been no vehicle for this to come to her attention, frankly.
All right. Mr. Crooks, your time expired. You're into Mr. McDonald.
I'm happy to defer to him, Your Honor.
Well, if you have a concluding remark, I don't want to cut you off.
My concluding remark would be this. Judge Bucklow said this was an extremely close call, the denial of fees. But while I conclude that plaintiff's complaint was meritless, I do not conclude that it was frivolous. She's met the legal standard for fees when she says meritless. And more important, we've also sought fees under Rule 38 for this appeal. Surely that line from Judge Bucklow would have warned them that it would be frivolous to pursue this appeal.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Crooks. Mr. McGonigal?
May it please the Court, my name is Tim McGonigal. I represent Leslie Magdabosco. I'd like to take just a few moments to address the somewhat unique situation that she is in this litigation. Unlike defendants Cassidy and Sosnowski, who were attorneys that presented DCF's case against plaintiff on the indicated findings of mental injury and substantial risk of physical harm to her own children, my client never had any contact or communication with plaintiff at any time, and never had any contact or communication with either Sosnowski or Cassidy at any time prior to the filing of the complaint. The contact she did have was shortly after the filing of the complaint. We notified Ms. Cooney, who was pro se at the time, that there had been no communications between these three co-defendants. There was no conspiracy. We asked her to non-suit the case, and she refused. What is clear is that plaintiff didn't non-suit the case, and when we ultimately moved to dismiss the case in front of Judge Bucklow, that was denied, but it set the tone for the litigation throughout the remainder. Judge Bucklow determined that plaintiff's conspiracy allegations have a distinctly paranoid gestalt, and it is unlikely that her claims have merit. We had to go through summary judgment to get to the end game, which was dismissal of the case as to summary judgment. We should have been entitled to that, arguably, at the motion to dismiss level, particularly given this very court's prior determination in Cooney versus Rossiter that it was paranoid pro se litigation to begin with.
If I could just get clear on the structure of this kind of litigation in the state courts or in the administrative proceeding and then in the state courts, your client is the paralegal who is working as an independent contractor.
So she's
employed by the private court reporting firm.
She is.
That has some sort of a contract with the Department of Family.
There's a contract between Benedia Court Reporting and DCFS that provided for this transcription after the fact.
Okay. So she doesn't have anything to do with running the cassette recording system or anything like
Absolutely
that.
Absolutely not.
That's handled by the ALJ within the confines of the administrative
Correct.
Procedure.
Correct. Judge Backley treated all of that.
Okay. So she doesn't have anything to do with that, clearly not responsible for the gaps in the tape and that sort of thing.
Correct.
Okay, so when a decision is made, making a finding of abuse, and then it gets appealed to the circuit court, which is what happened here, right?
Correct.
Who orders the transcript or the transcription of the audio cassette?
I believe DCFS orders the transcripts because they hold them. Ever since ALJ Backley conducted the hearings, they're in their custody, and they're submitted to Benedia. Benedia submits them to Magna Bosco. She does the transcripts. They go back electronically in terms of a transcript to Benedia, who provides them to DCFS. And at that point, they would be the official record for that appeal, but for the order that was entered within a year that substituted the Fishman transcripts,
so,
which were done at the site by court reporters that are officially licensed under the Illinois Certified Shorthand Reporters Act.
So it sounds like it's sort of a ministerial thing when the department gets one of these appeals. It has some clerical employee ask for the transcription from the court reporting agency, or do the attorneys do that?
No, the plaintiff did not. They actually become the record in the case, and at that point the plaintiff has access to them as any other party would. But my client's involvement had ceased once the moment they're transmitted to Benedia.
Right. Okay, I guess let me ask it differently. You don't know who at the department is responsible for ordering up the transcript.
The record reflects that there was a supervisor at DCFS that is in charge of that. Her name is identified in the record. It escapes me at the moment. But, again, that's a complete disconnect between the lawyers,
right.
Cassidy and Cassidy and Sosnowski.
It's clear that it's not the lawyer's function to order up the transcript.
Absolutely not.
Some clerical employee does it.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Gano, in support of your initial motion to dismiss, what did you submit in addition to the motion to the Judge Buckle?
It was directed to a number of allegations. There were immunity issues by the attorneys. As to my client, the 12B6 motion was really directed to a lack of sufficient allegations of conspiracy to sustain the case. Judge Buckle denied that, and we proceeded with discovery and summary judgment. For all of those reasons, we respectfully request this court to affirm summary judgment, but to reverse and remand as to the question of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Ms. Goldner?
Unfortunately, since I've been now made personally under attack by some very false allegations, I'd like to clarify some things before the court. One, I had no involvement in this case whatsoever till I came in and filed my appearance. I filed my appearance in this case, which was set to go before Judge Bucklow. For leave to file my appearance, I immediately received from counsel a threat that if I did not immediately dismiss the case, they would seek sanctions against me. I came in after the motion to dismiss was denied. During the course of the case, due to the conduct of the other attorneys with respect to the pro se litigant, I believe they were very unprofessional, they were degrading, they were humiliating her. As a result of it, I felt that I should come in on the case. I have also been involved in a number of Mrs. Cooney's other cases, specifically one in the Daily Center against Attorney Abadi, in which a substantial settlement was received. Another case that I inherited against the guardian ad litem out of Rockford was dismissed and affirmed on appeal because of a statute of limitations problem. Another due to an immunity problem. At no time, to my knowledge, at least in the cases that I've been involved in, has anybody determined that anything that Mrs. Cooney filed was frivolous in any way. In this case, no one has disputed the number of errors contained in the transcripts, or nobody has explained them. And I believe if this were to go before a jury, that the jury could infer the conspiracy and judge in favor of the plaintiff. With respect to the attorney's fees, I would ask the standard is abuse of discretion. The court was in a position to clearly view everything. This case is not a frivolous case, and I would ask the court to reverse the decision on summary judgment and affirm the decision on attorney's fees. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Golden. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement.